From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Another big step in Washington towards the impeachment of President Trump comes tomorrow when the full House meets to debate the articles of impeachment. And we wanted to take a closer look at partisanship and how it's playing out in this process. A number of vulnerable Democrats announced yesterday that they will back impeachment, while two Democrats in the House have said they are opposed and will go against their party. This situation is familiar to our next guest. Paul McHale is a former congressman from Pennsylvania and one of five Democrats who broke with the party and voted to impeach President Clinton back in 1998. And Congressman, this isn't really a question of Democrats that they're just dealing with this. Congressman Justin Amash of Michigan recently left the GOP. He's in favor of impeachment. What would you tell Congress members who are considering going against their party for this vote?
I think consistent with what the Constitution expected of members of the House, there are many routine votes that are cast quite properly with partisan considerations in mind. But I think under the Constitution, it's quite clear that a vote on impeachment is a very different kind of vote. It involves constitutional responsibility, not simply democratic representation. And so I wouldn't stick a finger in the wind on this vote. I certainly didn't. I cast a vote that was very difficult for me. I liked President Clinton. I had voted for him, but it became clear to me that he had lied under oath, and I felt the House had a duty to hold him accountable. Similarly, I would say to my Republican friends today, do what you think is right. This is a vote that will define your presence in the House. We are deciding what's good for the country, and I think that should trump all partisan considerations.
You know, back in 1998, Clinton was accused of lying under oath about his affair with intern Monica Lewinsky and obstruction of justice. One striking thing you said back then, as you voted to impeach him, was that you had future presidents in mind and that the rule of law was at stake. Looking back, it feels like a remarkable statement as we sit in the middle of this Trump impeachment process. Was this a hard decision for you? I mean, what pressures did you feel from your constituents in the party on this vote?
I had great difficulty deciding my vote with regard to President Clinton. I'd have no difficulty at all in the present situation. I believe that President Trump withheld national security funds from an ally solely to benefit his political interest. And if that's not an impeachable offense, I don't know what is.
I want to talk a little bit about partisanship. Here's Republican Jim Sensenbrenner in 1998 speaking about how the push to impeach Nixon had to be bipartisan. Let's listen.
I would ask my Democratic friends to be as bipartisan today as the Republicans were back in 1974 by rejecting this motion to recommit.
So you hear a Republican then calling for bipartisanship, and you know there's the argument out there. I know you've heard it that Clinton's actions really didn't threaten the country and that his impeachment was partisan. I'm really interested to know, do you think that many people see that very partisan impeachment of Clinton paving the way for the partisanship as we know it today and the impeachment process that's playing out today?
Yeah, Tanya, I can only speak for myself. In 1998, I don't think that President Clinton's sexual misconduct constituted an impeachable offense. If he had simply done what he had done in the Oval Office, I would never have voted for impeachment. What made it a public offense was his lengthy, deliberate lying under oath in a federal civil rights lawsuit. And so that's what made it an impeachable offense, not merely the tawdry activity in the Oval Office. Now, with regard to President Trump, again, I think it's a question of the rule of law and constitutional responsibility, not partisanship. Now, I had a lot of elections over the years, and I understand partisanship, and I don't dismiss it. There is a certain degree of loyalty to one's political party that's appropriate. But heaven help us if we can't, under the Constitution, set that aside. In a moment as serious as this, to cast a vote that is in the best interest of the nation, not in the best interest of a party, not in the best interest of one's own reelection. This is a vote that is going to be examined for many years to come. And I would urge the members of the House to take the long view in doing what's right, not merely what's popular.
That's Paul McHale. He's a former congressman from Pennsylvania. He was one of five Democrats who broke with his party and voted to impeach President Clinton. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, now to a new study that shows that better lighting can help older Americans with Alzheimer's and related dementias sleep better and experience less depression and agitation. The study by Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute's Lighting Research Center was published Friday in the Journal of Clinical Sleep. And for more, we're joined by Mariana Figuero, who's the lead researcher on the study and director of the Lighting Research Center. Mariana, what exactly were you studying?
Well, we're looking at how light impacts sleep and behavior in Alzheimer's disease patients. And we measure two ways. We look at actigraphy, which is sort of an objective measure of sleep, as well as we collect questionnaire data on behavior and mood in this population.
And what kind of lighting are you talking about?
The lighting we're using is really tuned to maximally impact the circadian system of these patients. So that tends to be brighter than the typical light that you have in nursing homes, as well as a little bit more bluer. And we're giving that light only during the daytime hours, from the time they get up until 6 p.m., and then we drop the light levels because you want to have a very robust light and dark, and that's the way we're achieving that.
To mimic the sun, basically.
Pretty much. Obviously, it's less bright than the sun, but at least it's a lot brighter than what you typically find in nursing homes and assisted living facilities.
So what were the major takeaways from your study?
It improves the sleep. It reduces depression, reduces agitation. And from observations from the nurses and the caregivers, they were more social. They were eating better. They were behaving better. It was really a very, I think, amazing results, because when you consider that you're in the field, you are in nursing homes, these are moderate to late stages of dementia, and you see the impact beautifully happen. And we also had a placebo light, so it was a light that was ineffective, but we were just telling them that we were testing what kind of light was better. And we saw that there was no effect with the placebo, but we saw the significant effect with the active lighting interventions. I mean, it was hypothesized that that's what we were going to get, but it's really nice to see the results coming out.
Well, and it also seems to suggest that most patients in nursing homes and assisted living are not exposed to enough light.
They are not. And I think one of the takeaways for me for the study is we can do a lot better than what we're doing right now in designing and implementing lighting in nursing homes and assisted living facilities. And I think it's such an easy way of doing it. We now have the technology. It's energy efficient. So if you increase the amount of light, it's not going to hurt as much, you know, your pocket in terms of energy. And the benefits are very impressive. So I think that my hope is that people are going to start thinking about doing better lighting in these kinds of environments.
I wonder if it applies to the general population as well as people who are suffering from dementia or Alzheimer's.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we're working with Sunnyview Rehab here in the Albany area with traumatic brain injury patients, and we're seeing very similar results. We're retrofitting the lighting in their rooms. We're also working with Mount Sinai in New York, where we're retrofitting the lighting in cancer patients' room, myeloma transplant patients, and we're seeing very similar results. So the principles are the same. I think the Alzheimer's population, it's great because they are in one space the entire time. So it's very easy to give them that robust light dark pattern because we can control that. So it's sort of the obvious place to start. And I think from there, you can expand to any other population without any doubt.
What gave you and the other researchers the idea to look into the effect of lighting on people who are dealing with any number of diseases?
Well, it's knowing that light has this very strong impact on your biological clock. It really is the main synchronizer of your biological clock to the local time on Earth or the local position on Earth. So knowing that light has such an impact, and then knowing that the type of light that affects the biological clock is different than the type of light that affects vision. And we tend to design the spaces just for vision. So understanding that and seeing that we're really in biological darkness when it comes to the lighting in the built environment. So we took those patients out of biological darkness and we see the positive impact right away.
If somebody is listening to this and they are taking care of an elderly relative at home, is there anything that they can do now to help make the lighting better?
They can. I think open up the windows, sit by windows, and let daylight come in. Go outside for a walk in the morning every day at the same time. If you can't do that, bring in more light. So add more of those table lamps or floor lamps. Increase the amount of light in the homes. But do that only during the daytime, especially in the morning hours. I would say put 4 times more light than what you have right now. That's probably what you need. But if you can go outside, go for a walk, half an hour, that should at least help.
That is Mariana Figueroa, who is the lead researcher on a new study about lighting and patients with Alzheimer's and other dementias. She is director of the Lighting Research Center at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Very interesting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The NBC sitcom Friends turned 25 this year, and it's still here. Right now, it's one of Netflix's biggest shows. But does it hold up?
The greatest failure, I think, of the show is that it's not funny.
What our enduring relationship with Friends says about us. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Many skin cancers go undetected because they're in places that most of us can't see, like the back of our necks or the scalp. But you know who often sees those areas? Your hairstylist or barber. And researchers say they could be in the first line of defense in catching one of the most deadly forms of skin cancer, melanoma. Joining us now is Susie Music, a teacher at Paul Mitchell, the school in St. Louis, Missouri. Susie trains people for careers in beauty and hairstyling and has been a cosmetologist for over 40 years. Susie, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yes. So this is something that we may not think about, but it really makes perfect sense. Our barbers and hairstylists are literally standing over our heads. You've had personal experience spotting melanomas. Tell us more about that.
Throughout my career, I have recommended many people that I have seen suspicious-looking things on their head and scalp and ears and neck, and have recommended them to actually go to see a dermatologist. And as a matter of fact, yes, several of them did have to have them removed. And a very dear friend of mine had a melanoma on her scalp also. And if her hairdresser would not have detected it, she probably would not be here today. So it's so, so important.
Wow. I mean, it sounds also, while not common, it happens often. Were these difficult conversations to have?
Actually, they weren't. That is one of the things I work with my students at the school about, talking to someone about something like this. Usually what I would say is, you know, I've noticed something that looks a little suspicious on your scalp. Have you ever noticed it before? And then usually the conversation heads into, no, I didn't know that. And so then I usually say, well, I'm not sure what it is, but the next time you go to your doctor, or if you'd like me to take a picture of it, I can take a picture of it so that you actually have a visual. You might want to have it checked out because it could possibly, you know, be something that you really need to have attention to.
There's now a nationwide challenge to get hairstylists to spot potentially cancerous moles on their clients' heads, but so many don't really know what to look for. You train your stylists to do scalp inspections. What does that training look like?
Well, the training that we use is actually a program called Eyes on Cancer, and I was involved in helping get it started. It is on the internet, of course, and we use it to teach our students what to look for. There are several different examples. There's a skin card that we hand out so they can see the difference between the different types of melanomas or moles. We usually do this program about once every 6 to 8 months because we have a completely, you know, turnaround. We have a complete turnaround of students about every year. So we try to make sure that the student gets this training at least once while they're in school.
You've been, as I mentioned, in the cosmetology industry for over 40 years. And really what I'm hearing from you, though, is if a hairstylist sees anything abnormal on the scalp, it's really a simple conversation to have with your client that, hey, I'm seeing something that may be normal, but it may not, and you should just check it out.
Exactly. very easy conversation to have once you have some training on it. I think so many times today with all of the technology that we have that sometimes our students, cosmetologists, the communication skills maybe, you know, you need to have a little bit of help with that. And that's what we're there for, is to help them be professional and not alarm a client when we do see something like that.
How's your friend doing now? You mentioned that her hairstylist spotted something on her scalp.
She's doing great, and she actually has spoken at some of our events that we have had, and she came in and spoke about how fortunate she was that it was found by her hairdresser, and she's 100% great. She still, though, has to go very often, about every 3 months, to be checked since she has had a melanoma, but she's doing well, and she attributes it to early detection.
Man, I mean, I know that most hairstylists, probably yourself included, you didn't get into this business for this, but it's got to feel good to know that you may be saving someone's life.
Exactly. It is. And it's just so rewarding being able to especially teach our students and to actually be able to talk to our clients about such personal things.
Susie Music is a former hairstylist and current teacher at Paul Mitchell, the school in St. Louis, Missouri. Susie, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And as Susie said, early detection is so important, which is why having a regular stylist who can see these changes often helps. Joining us now to talk more about early detection is Dr. Ramona Bashad, a dermatologist and assistant professor in the Department of Dermatology at St. Louis University School of Medicine. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about your program. You started Stylists Against Skin Cancer. Tell me more about what the program does.
So, you know, we had a week where about four or five patients came in with very aggressive melanomas that were all found on the scalp, and they were all identified by their hairstylists. Yeah. And all of these melanomas were caught relatively early. So that is when you want to catch the melanomas. You don't want to catch them when they become advanced or spread to other parts of the body. So yeah. I started to think about how I could leverage hairstylists in assisting the dermatologist, as they had in that, you know, three or four cases. And what I realized was that a lot of them were actually very hungry for education, but the way that their schooling and education is set up, they get very limited education in medical things that could affect the scalp.
Yes, because I can only imagine that if a hairstylist sees something on someone's scalp, I mean, they need to know exactly what they're looking at. So training is very important when it comes to that. It could be something like a mole or a skin tag. So understanding the difference.
Right. You know, I can tell you as a physician, patients don't love coming to see their physicians, but they do look forward to seeing their hairstylists. Hairstylists see their clients, you know, on a monthly, bi-monthly basis. Dermatologists, you're lucky if you get to see them, you know, once or twice a year. And because of that frequent nature of the visits that you have with your hairstylist, they can actually monitor things. They can see that something wasn't there the last month or something wasn't there 2 months ago.
I was just wondering about the idea that, of course, if you're having this discussion and someone says, I see something that looks like you should have it checked out. Is there any risk with that, like in bringing up cancer, causing unnecessary emotional stress?
In most cases, people are very appreciative, but it does have to be brought up in the right way and in very Yep. similar terminology to what you just used, which is something that's not alarming, but just to let the client know, you know, I see a spot here on your scalp that I didn't notice a month or two ago. You may want to have this evaluated just to make sure that there's, you know, nothing unhealthy growing on your scalp. And the nice thing about the program is that it connects hairstylists with dermatologists that are local to them. And it equips them with these sort of business cards that they can give to clients where, you know, there's an image of the scalp. They put an X where they see what they're concerned about. And then on the back is a website where the client can then go look up, a dermatologist that's close to them. What it lets the hairstylist do is connect the client with someone who can then go ahead and evaluate things further.
So a question for you. I mean, your program is in St. Louis. It sounds like it's an amazing program. What would you say to hairstylists throughout the country who are hearing you, but they may not be that comfortable with speaking up? What resources do they have?
You know, we actually are starting to take this program around the country. So I'm hopeful that they will get this education. Through the American Society for Dermatologic Surgery, on their website, there are PowerPoint slides and resources for people to, obtain this educational material. There's also a mnemonic that we came up with, which is shade, and it's supposed to be a pun on the word hair shade because a lot of hairstylists understand that term. But it describes what you're looking for. So S is for surface. If something is elevated or depressed below the level of the skin. H, is for height. A is for age. So skin cancer is much more likely in people who are 40 and above. And as I get older, I actually think that's quite young. But, 40 and above is where skin cancer really starts to become more frequent. And then the D and E is what we would love. And that is for the hairstylist to feel comfortable or have a connection with the dermatologist. It stands for, dermatologic evaluation. Mm. And really the point of including that in the mnemonic was to reassure hairstylists that, again, they're not alone in making this diagnosis or telling clients what they have on their scalp if they do find something on the scalp that is unhealthy.
Dr. Ramona Bashad is a dermatologist and assistant professor in the Department of Dermatology at St. Louis University School of Medicine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world, and when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
As the stock market overall appears poised to gain 20% or so this year, Boeing may end the year with its shares about where they started. And you can chalk that up to the 737 MAX. The company announced yesterday it will pause production of the MAX starting next month because the Federal Aviation Administration is still reviewing whether the plane is safe to fly. For more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy.
And did Boeing really have any choice in this matter, given that the FAA hasn't given it the all clear? And what does this mean for Boeing to pause production?
This is a very big deal because they had about 5,000 of these planes on back order, and they were making about 50 a month. They'd reduced it to about 40 a month, and they're all backlogged now. They're sitting in storage because they can't sell these planes. They can't give the planes over to the people buying them because they're not cleared to do so. So the bottom line is they're just piling up airplanes, and this has gone from what was a small problem, and I don't want to minimize plane crashes, but they thought it was a small problem that could be easily fixed. And as they have delayed this, we have learned more and more about these planes, and more people are having pause about flying on them, putting them back into service, approving them, buying them. So, no, I think in the end, this was not Boeing's choice.
And what does it mean for all of the employees who make this plane?
Well, for the moment, I mean, Boeing is a very, very big company. It's in space work. It's in defense work. It's in airplanes. So it says it's going to redeploy the 12,000 workers who build the MAX plane to other projects. And for the moment, it is not saying that it expects layoffs or furloughs. That said, this is a major, major project. I mean, they are making, as I say, about 40 of these planes a month, or they were. So something's going to have to happen. Boeing doesn't have somewhere, obviously, to put these workers. And when you start to think about 12,000 workers, that could actually have some impact on the economy. These are people who they're strong earners, and they're involved in a major project that has at least 10 years or more of life in it. So it's going to become a problem if this plane doesn't get approved for service fairly soon.
Now, the reason that the plane is grounded is because of the two crashes, one in Indonesia, the other in Ethiopia. The Ethiopian crash happened in March.
Yep.
And since then, despite all the work that's been done to fix the problems with the MAX, I'm not sure anybody would feel safe at this point flying in one. What is it going to take to get the confidence level up to get these planes back in the air?
So with airplanes, it always becomes a leadership by the company, the FAA, sort of getting the media and the public on side. The CEO of Boeing the other day said that he actually called this. He said this could be the safest plane ever. Mm-hmm. Now, 340 people have died on these things. Planes like the 787, the A350, no one's ever died on them. So statistically, that's probably not even possible. And earlier this month, there was a former Boeing manager who told the House Transportation Committee at Congress that for the first time in his life, he said, "I'm hesitant about putting my family on a Boeing airplane." Now, the truth probably lies somewhere in between the two, that it may not be deadly, it may not be the safest plane ever, but this is up to Boeing to somehow demonstrate to the public what it has done to make these planes safe, and then have everybody, have aerospace writers and journalists and safety people say, yeah, they believe it. Part of the problem is Boeing took so long to acknowledge the problem that it has hurt their reputation.
That is Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, thanks.
My pleasure.
The Iowa caucuses are 48 days away, and Democratic presidential candidates are preparing for their sixth debate on Thursday night in Los Angeles. Joining us for a look at the state of the race is NPR national political correspondent Asma Khalid. Hi, Asma.
Hey, Jeremy.
Okay, well, let's start with the recent polls, which show that there is kind of a top four emerging right now in the race. Joe Biden at the top, then Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and then Pete Buttigieg. Do you agree that that's the top four, and are things still fluid?
Yeah, I would wholeheartedly agree. I mean, this is the top four candidate field that we've been seeing now for a couple of months. It's something that was confirmed in the latest NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll that we put out yesterday. And, you know, I think there are some candidates who are trying to bump up, and we see some of them resonate a little bit more in some of the early states, say like Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, who seems to be tracking well in terms of local, you know, on-the-ground sentiment in Iowa, but we don't see that translating out to national sentiment at this point.
And what about Michael Bloomberg, who has started to rise in some of the polls, kind of still below Pete Buttigieg, but he's going up as he spends so much money. He's not going to be on the debate stage Thursday night. Will that matter to his campaign?
Yeah, I mean, you're right, you know, Jeremy, in saying that he has been bumping up a bit. We see him at 5% or 6% in some of these national polls. You know, my take on this is at this point in time, he's kind of a fascination for a number of voters. He will not be on the debate stage in part because he's not really playing in any of the early voting states. So at Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, Nevada, that's not his game plan. His game plan is that he will essentially just compete in states after that point. You know, will it matter that he's not on the debate stage? I think for any candidate who is seriously trying to contend for the nomination, to be on this debate stage to see how you interact with some of your competitors is crucial. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've seen that. We've seen how Joe Biden has been able to be somewhat resilient despite attacks during some of these debates. And we've also seen how Elizabeth Warren has been hit a number of times, say, on her stances for Medicare for All during some of these debates, and how that has affected her in the long run. So him not being in the debate stage, I think it does hurt him. I mean, he'll still be allowed to, you know, put out ads that show his message nationally. But at this point in the game, at this point in the campaign, you do need to be competing rather sort of effectively in Iowa and New Hampshire in particular.
Okay, well, let's see if we can quickly try to get through the top four candidates, starting with Joe Biden. Today, his campaign is putting out an ad of speech highlights in early voting states.
We give Donald Trump four more years. This will not be the country envisioned by Washington. This will not be the nation bound together by Lincoln. This will not be the nation lifted up by Roosevelt or inspired by Kennedy. It will not be the nation that Barack Obama proved bends toward justice.
Now, Asma, he's, of course, come up in the impeachment fight with Republicans accusing him and his son of corruption in Ukraine. He got into an argument a couple weeks ago with an Iowa voter about that. Over the summer, he was struggling to raise as much money as his rivals. How's he doing now?
So, you know, Jeremy, what we've seen from Joe Biden is that despite all of these things that you outlined, his campaign has been remarkably resilient as the months have gone on. I've seen him, you know, most notably, I would say, in South Carolina and Nevada, states that have more diverse electorates, and he's still remarkably popular. He brings out really large crowds. He had the Culinary Union in Las Vegas. His message seems to resonate with people despite, you know, some of the questions that we've seen thus far, both from Republicans and some of his opponents.
Okay, in interviews and at rallies, Bernie Sanders has been criticizing some of his rivals for taking big money donations. Here he is in Ottumwa, Iowa on Sunday.
I don't think that's the democracy we want. We want a democracy of one person, one vote. We want a democracy where there is a clash of ideas and not big money buying elections. That's why together we will overturn Citizens United and move to public funding of elections.
It sounds a little like he's going after Bloomberg or Tom Steyer. They're the billionaires in the race. He is, Sanders, staying in the top tiers in the polls. What's the state of his campaign?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, just like Joe Biden, I would say he's been remarkably resilient. He has a really loyal base of followers. And I do think that early on in this campaign, there was an assumption that some of his supporters might go to a candidate like Elizabeth Warren. But when you look at the polls, Bernie Sanders still seems to have a plurality of support from progressives and young people. Another key constituency for him are Latinos. And I was actually out in Nevada just this past week. He seems to look better in the polling than even Joe Biden. When you talk about Latino voters, it's a constituency he did pretty well with in 2016, and he's been building up larger support from Latinos, from younger voters of color. And I think that we're seeing that in terms of just his overall resiliency thus far.
Okay, let's talk about Elizabeth Warren, who is on a Fair Share road tour in southeast Iowa. Last week, she spoke about the economy in a speech at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics.
The rich and the powerful have written the rules for our economy so that they suck up all the gains for themselves. It is corruption, plain and simple, and it is holding back growth in our economy.
Asma, Warren has slipped in the polls lately after some worry that her Medicare for All plan would be a problem for her with voters who don't want to lose their current health coverage. She seems to be starting to moderate that plan a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of what's happening for Elizabeth Warren is, and I would argue that the slippage in the polls actually even predates a little bit when she came out with specific concrete policy plans. It was because of the fact that this is a candidate who has, you know, enunciated really clear policy positions on so many things, but she kept saying that there would be no middle class tax increase, but yet she was going to have a Medicare for all system that eliminates private insurance. And that's kind of when we began to see a little bit of her slipping in the polls. You know, as time has gone on, I think that what she's struggled to do is to kind of clearly articulate a middle ground between both Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg. And when you look at where her support is coming from, it's coming from both progressives and a lot of college-educated whites. These are folks who support different candidates in the field right now. And some of this, I do think, is getting a little muddled because she's put out a Medicare for All plan. This is an idea, you know, eliminating private insurance is not an idea that a plurality of voters want. And so she's trying to sell a position to voters that not everybody seems on board with, or at this point, they seem a little nervous about.
Let's talk about Pete Buttigieg, who was fundraising in Silicon Valley yesterday, and reporters asked him about the head of Netflix, Reed Hastings, who's an advocate of private charter schools, hosting a fundraiser for him.
So I'm very clear where I stand on these issues. There are 700,000 donors to my campaign. Some of them may disagree with me on some of those issues, but my stance will not change, including my support for teachers and my support for labor.
Asma, how is Buttigieg holding up under the increased scrutiny of breaking into the top tier of candidates?
You know, I would say he's been actually pretty effective in terms of being able to combat criticism that he's faced. I would argue one of the most frequent criticisms he's received is his lack of support amongst voters of color. And when he's been criticized for this, I mean, I'm thinking most notably there was a pretty candid piece in The Root by Michael Harriet, who criticized Pete Buttigieg. What the mayor of South Bend, Indiana did was he called the author, and then the author wrote about what happened. So he's, you know, taken a kind of effective tactic of when he's been criticized to kind of candidly explore those conversations in a way that we don't often see candidates do. I mean, that being said, though, Jeremy, he still has struggled and continues to struggle with voters of color in the polls. And I do argue that, you know, it's a very hard thing to do to pull off and become the nominee of the Democratic Party if you cannot get a substantial amount of support from Black and Latino voters.
Two other candidates will be at the debate. That would be Tom Steyer and Andrew Yang. And eight candidates will not be at the debate. Cory Booker, Julian Castro, Amy Klobuchar, Tulsi Gabbard, Michael Bennett, John Delaney, Deval Patrick, and Marianne Williamson. Anything we should say about all of those people?
I mean, at this point, a number of them are still trying to gain ground, specifically in Iowa, with the idea being that if they could pull off an upset win in Iowa, that could potentially catapult them on further. At this point, you know, there are two people in particular amongst that list, I think, that I want to point out to, and that is Amy Klobuchar, a senator from Minnesota, as well as New Jersey Senator Cory Booker. Both of them have been building up, you know, I would say fairly substantial, robust, whether it's ground games or endorsement lists, both in Iowa and New Hampshire. I think the difficulty, again, is, as you know, we were talking about earlier, if you're not on the debate stage, that's just a lot of kind of free airtime to deliver your message that these candidates are not going to get. And yes, Iowa is very, very important, but the national narratives that we see for these candidates matters. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's to the point why we see a candidate like Michael Bloomberg kind of bumping up in the national polls. Airtime does matter.
Well, and President Trump, who will be their eventual opponent, is getting a lot of airtime himself, holding another rally in Michigan tonight. And a Quinnipiac poll out has him at his highest approval rating ever in that poll, 43%. That is Asma Khalid, NPR national political correspondent. Asma, thank you.
You're welcome.
There were 22 executions in the United States this year, down from 25 in 2018. These numbers, according to a report issued by the Death Penalty Information Center, are part of a larger trend that shows a decline in the use of capital punishment in America. The report, which was issued today, highlights New Hampshire's decision to abolish the death penalty earlier this year and California's moratorium on executions as some of the reasons why. We have with us now the author of the study, Robert Dunham. He's executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, yeah, so let's get started with the evidence that the death penalty is on the decline. What else does your 2019 report find?
The report shows that the death penalty is disappearing from whole regions of the country and eroding in others. You mentioned New Hampshire. New Hampshire is the 21st state to abolish the death penalty. California, when it imposed the moratorium, made it so there are now 25 states that either don't have a death penalty at all or have gubernatorial moratoria against executions. There is now a whole area in the Northeast where there really isn't a death penalty at all. And we had the fifth straight year where there were fewer than 50 death sentences imposed. Contrast that to the mid-1990s, when in 1994, 95, and 96, each of those years, there were more than 300 death sentences imposed. So
wow.
We're looking at an 85% reduction.
What are some of the reasons that we're seeing this decline? I'm wondering, are prosecutors less likely to seek the death penalty? What are some of the reasons you're seeing?
Part of it is that states have moved away from the death penalty by abolishing it. We've had nine states abolish the death penalty this century. But also, people are becoming more and more aware of the defects in the system. We had two more exonerations this year, and that brings to 166 the number of people who are wrongly convicted and sent to death row and been exonerated since 1973. We also have tremendous evidence of the geographic arbitrariness of capital punishment. Whether you get the death penalty depends less on what you're accused of doing than who the prosecutor is in the county in which you're accused.
Right. You've seen actually this. Talk more about this, that it seems that capital punishment is geographically isolated. And I'm just wondering what this tells us about public sentiment in those areas.
90% of the executions this year were in the South. But even then, the number of new death sentences lags far behind. So we had, for example, in Texas, which had more executions than anywhere else in the country, had nine. That was still a decrease from last year, and there were only four new death sentences that were imposed in the entire state. So we're seeing, even though it's concentrated in the South, we're still seeing significant reductions in the number of new death sentences there.
What's happening at the federal level, including how the Supreme Court is now handling death penalty cases?
The court has been taking fewer death penalty cases to review the merits, whether there was an appropriate conviction and an appropriate death sentence. They've been denying review in a number of cases, and the court has expressed increasing hostility to attempts to challenge the method of execution and to obtain stays of execution. So yeah. I think going forward, the question is going to be how seriously is the court going to attempt to enforce constitutional rights? They seem to be right now very hostile to the question of stopping executions. So we'll have to see.
Yeah. I mentioned I asked you about public sentiment, and a Gallup poll shows that 60% of Americans believe life in prison is a better punishment for murder than the death penalty. Your organization does not take a position on the death penalty, but you are critical of how prisoners are put to death, correct?
The Death Penalty Information Center provides information and analysis on death penalty issues, but we're critical of the way in which it's administered, because if you're going to have a death penalty, you should have a death penalty that is fairly administered, consistently administered, not arbitrary. And as the number of death sentences has decreased by 85% and the number of executions has dropped by 75%, the hope would be that prosecutors would start really tailoring the cases in which they sought the death penalty to the narrow group of the worst crimes and the worst of the worst offenders. In fact, that hasn't been the case. 22 executions this year, the second lowest in 28 years, but they were not the worst of the worst crimes and the worst of the worst offenders. 18 of the 22 were individuals who had evidence of serious mental illness, of brain damage, of chronic exposure, lifelong trauma, and a number of them were people who were aged 18 to 21 at the time of the crime. Mm-hmm. It turns out that we are not seeking the death penalty against the worst of the worst and executing the worst of the worst. It's now tending to be those defendants who are the most vulnerable and the cases in which there's the worst of the worst legal process.
Robert Dunham is executive director at the Death Penalty Information Center and author of the group's 2019 report, which is out today. There's a link to that study at hereandnow.org. Thank you for speaking with us, Robert.
Thank you for having me back.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. For only the fourth time in history, the House of Representatives gets set to vote on articles of impeachment against a president.
The vote is expected to fall largely along party lines, with Democrats voting to approve and Republicans standing by the president.
We'll have that and the rest of the day's news next time on Here and Now.